swoon over French food, we clamor for Thai, we get downright smug about Indian cuisine. In his newest book, Mario Batali celebrates the big, messy melting pot that is American cuisine. Big American Cookbook presents 250 out-of-the-ordinary recipes from across the U.S., from Navajo fry bread tacos to shrimp jambalaya and Ozark pudding. Anyone with a sense of culinary adventure will delight in eating their way across the country. Mario Batali counts 25 restaurants, 10 cookbooks, numerous TV shows, and the Eataly marketplaces among his ever-expanding empire of deliciousness. Big American Cookbook is published by Grand Central Life and Style. Welcome, Mario.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in Seattle. Although you grew up in Seattle, you're best known for Italian food. What made you want to write a book about American cooking?
I have been traveling around the country either promoting my Italian books or just traveling for vacation or enjoyable pleasure. And every time I go somewhere, I always ask the locals, where the best place to eat that doesn't have a reservation policy?
Because you're not planning ahead.
Exactly. And that's where you find the local and traditional dishes that make up the backbone of American real cuisine. This isn't a selection of recipes that you need to source at exotic shopping locations online. This is stuff you buy at the regular grocery store. And provided you pay attention to it, you can make some really delicious, interesting, thoughtful dishes from all over the country that I fell in love with in each little place that I stopped.
Now, when many people think of American cuisine, they think, you know, Thanksgiving turkey or cheeseburgers. But how do you describe American cuisine?
I describe it as basically however anybody got to wherever they are through whatever thread of immigration, where we ever found ourselves is how we became who we are. And whether you're from Northeastern Europe or whether you're from the Mediterranean or whether you're from India or China or Morocco or South America, Central America, your immigration story tells a lot about you. But as you embrace America and everything great and often odd about America, you modify it and you become something completely part of the fabric that is our magnificent quilt. And that's what I discovered along this road. And when you're eating in the northern Midwest, you're really eating from kind of the Eastern European stock, whether it's fried sauerkraut balls or something as delightful as hanky pankies.
Ooh, what's a hanky panky?
A hanky panky is where you take equal parts ground beef and spicy sausage. You cook it until it starts to crackle. Mm. Then you drain it of the fat and you add ricotta and either Gouda or Munster cheese. Then you spread it on toasted black or rye bread and you put it under the broiler. And you serve it as you watch the Cleveland Browns lose yet again.
Oh my God, I need to eat
it
that.
It is so good. I learned it first from Michael Simon, actually.
Oh,
then
really?
On further inspection into the vast and delightful cuisine of Cleveland, found that it's a regular dish that a lot of people serve at their tailgates or their football parties.
You know, I spend a lot of time with Junior League cookbooks. It's
right.
It's a personal little hobby of mine.
Right.
And I have not come across a lot of these dishes. I mean, I thought that I would know a lot about, you know, off-the-wall America, or just not off-the-wall, but, you know, historic and oft-neglected restaurants. But, I mean, recipes. But a lot of these things surprised me. What were some of the surprising ones for you? I mean, you mentioned sauerkraut balls. You mentioned hanky-panky. Were there other surprises that surprise dishes that you found when you were traveling?
Well, I would say that each one of them presented me with something delightful. I mean, you know, when you go to Texas and you think I'm going to eat chili, and you kind of know that it's going to be a lot, and there's going to be Texas chili all over the place. But when you discover the magnificent depth of flavor that you get from using four or five different types of chilies, and that there's no beans in real chili in Texas. And it's just like each of these little bites is something that so tantalized me. And so, I mean, I started with probably 1,000 and we edited it down to 250. These are the ones that I think are just kind of remarkable. I mean, you know, it's surprising. I would say like a lomi lomi is surprising. For me, a pear salad is surprising only because it's so intuitively right when you first taste it. You're never like, oh my God, I never would have thought of this. It's more like, oh my God, how come I didn't have this before?
Right. And so when you whittled it down from the 1,000 recipes, well, first of all, where did those 1,000 recipes come from?
Well,
was
as I traveled around, from people. I mean, okay. I would sit down and I would eat at a diner or a Greasy Spoon or a great little restaurant that doesn't have a reservation policy. I would ask either the server or the cook or somebody to describe it to me verbally. I didn't want them to write it down because I didn't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
Nor did I want to deal with, you know, saying, I got this recipe from this person. It was kind of like, it lived in my head. And then as I tried to reproduce it, it just came from whether it was a restaurant or whether it was at a state fair.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the kind of dishes that I tasted. And as I kind of made what I thought was the dish, I tried to keep it as pure as possible like they made it, because it would be very easy for me to make it a Mario Batali-ized dish. And so in each of the recipes, or a lot of them, you'll see at the bottom, there's a little orange print where I would say, if I was serving this at my house, I might add a little bit of chopped jalapeno.
Right. And did you keep, so you wanted to keep the purity of the recipe, but did you kind of say that you had several versions of the same thing?
Right.
Then would you pick one version, or did you mash them up a little bit?
I kind of mashed them up a little bit. I mean, I wanted it to make sure that it tasted like the one that I remembered in my head.
I see. And sometimes that takes a little
bit
of...
Well, because also I didn't necessarily look at the pure, real, written recipe. But as you said, I was looking at a Junior League recipe, or I was looking at a, you know, a Rotary Club recipe, or I was looking at the Wednesday paper in some small town in Iowa when they did their classic roundup of their favorite dishes at the end of the year. And I would just kind of think, that's an interesting look on it.
There's a lot of history in the book, which I just love, including the origins of a lot of the dishes. For instance, tell us about Kentucky Hot Browns.
Well, Kentucky Hot Browns is basically a turkey and gravy sandwich. And, you know, the when you have them and when you make them, it's very much something you would make after Thanksgiving. But it's very much part of the Kentucky culture, and they're very excited about it. So it's delicious to me, but it's all about the gravy and all about the bread.
And their little twist on it was cheese, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, here's a recipe that I had to look at a couple of times to really take in. Chipped beef dip.
Yes.
Now, where did you have chipped beef dip? And tell us what that is.
Chipped beef dip is where you take a dried beef product and you...
Like a jerky kind of
thing?
Yeah,
like a jerky. But it's not... It comes in a jar. Have you ever seen this product?
You know, I'm actually embarrassed to say I've never seen a jar of chipped beef in my life. Where does one get a jar of chipped beef in New York?
I'm not really sure. If you can find it in New York, I would say maybe you can get it at that English place, Keswick's.
Oh,
I would imagine they have it there.
Okay.
But you could also find it probably online, which I don't want you to do, though. I want you to go get it.
Okay. I'm going to go get it.
But it's a delicious amalgamation of this very... I would say if you couldn't find it, you would find the ends of brisaula and use those, because it's a dried beef product.
I love that. That's really like good. It's probably this really sort of humble thing, and then we're going
right,
to use it with brisaula.
We're going to make it. We're going to make it $25 a pound if we can.
Exactly. And then you take it and you put it with, you chop it up and make it into a dip?
Yes. It's very much like a cream sauce that you would put chipped beef on toast, which had a funny little renaissance in the American military where they called it something else.
Yeah, we won't repeat that on a family.
It was on a shingle.
On a family radio show,
right,
like
exactly.
This. Go on.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to ask you, so when you eat this, is this like something that you put bread in, or do you do chips?
You put chips or vegetables if you're trying to be healthy.
Well,
like
really.
Celery sticks.
Yeah, of course. Chipped beef dip with celery
with
sticks.
With celery sticks. Exactly.
For everybody's next cocktail party.
Right, exactly. It's for the fiber.
Another one that I want to talk about is Ozark pudding, just because it's such a simple, humble, homey sounding dish, but I'd never come across it. So it's apples,
yes.
And it's almost like a cake.
Yes, exactly. It actually tastes a lot cakier than you'd imagine, but it's delicious. It's simple, and it's apple-y, and it's floury and eggy. I mean, I think one of the most amazing things about this book is that there's more desserts in this book than I've ever, ever made.
And pies. Oh, my gosh, pies.
And what you'll see is that the pie ingredients are almost always the same. There's butter, there's sugar, there's some kind of dairy, and there's eggs. And as you mix them together, whether it's a chess pie or whether it's even the Concord grape pies, they're almost all thickened in exactly the same way. And yet they come out in such a unique and delicious variety that it's amazing.
Is pie one of your favorite desserts? Or is it just one of the most prevalent things that you
found? Pie is without a doubt my favorite dessert.
Okay.
I mean, actually, no, I'll tell you. My favorite dessert is fresh picked blackberries and vanilla ice cream.
Ooh.
And if I had to choose a dessert that somebody made, it would be my mom's blackberry pie with vanilla ice cream.
And you also did blackberry jam. You
yes.
talked a lot about that in the intro. You talk about growing up and making jam and preserving.
And pickles. And that's
pickles.
A big part of this book.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to some other people this morning, and they were saying, well, are you worried that pickling is going to become a cliche because some groovy hipsters are doing it in Williamsburg? And I'm like, the last thing you have to worry about is whether if people are doing it in Williamsburg, which is the epicenter of cool right now, that it's going to take away from its initial grooviness. And pickling and preserving is a way that Americans have always done how to live through the winter when you don't have your seasonal stuff and you didn't have a grocery store filled with already made jams or frozen stuff, which is still good and not bad. The idea that you can get a raspberry in February is not bad because obviously people want to buy it. But if you made your own raspberry jam from raspberries that you picked or bought from a local market, it tastes 10 times better. And in that same way, when you harvest so many beans at the end of the summer and you actually pickle them like my Aunt Marty made dilly beans, it is something that is so... It's a moment of pride for you, but when you serve them to someone and they're so good and they're so personalized, that's what American cuisine is. It's really personalizing all of these things by doing it your own self with your own hands. And when I taste something that someone made with their own hands like that, that for me is the ultimate gift. Like for me, I'm so much more impressed with that than I am with caviar or foie gras or fancy stuff.
Oh, good. I'm going to get you dilly beans for Christmas then. It'll save me a lot of money. No, but you know what's interesting about what you said is that preserving, pickling, canning culture is so deep and it is so ingrained, not just in our society, but in every society. Anybody who needed to preserve food and needed to eat through the winter has a tradition of canning, right? We're not going to let, you know, the fact that it's trendy now take away from how essential it is to us as humans, really.
Right. And not only essential, but it's an expression of your own personal way. Like how many other thousand ways they make duck confit? There's a thousand ways to do it. But it was because they didn't have ducks in the winter. So you preserved all of the bounty of during that special season, and that's what makes sense. And whether it's super salty or whether it's super thymy or super garlicky or super rosemary, that's all the beauty of the individual cook.
A caller says that you can get chipped beef at Acme, a New Jersey and Pennsylvania grocery chain. Thank you very much for calling in.
Fantastic.
And also another caller, Jessica from New Jersey, says that her grandmother made Ozark pudding in Syracuse, New York. And they have German roots, and it's a flat cake, and it's sort of like granola, and you'd crumble it. Oh, this is interesting. She would crumble it and put whipped cream on top. And so I guess it would almost be like a fool, you know, or a trifle.
Really?
Interesting. And her family still makes it.
Fantastic.
Well,
I would love her recipe.
You can send the recipe to Mario. He'll be waiting for it.
Fantastic. I love the idea of crumbled cake. I think, you know, that's also very trendy right now in New York restaurants where they take a cake and they tear it up and put stuff on the plate so that it looks a little bit different than the circular mold.
And also think about, I'm so done with the circular mold, so I love the difference in presentation. But let's also talk about cornbread crumbled into buttermilk. You know, that was one of those things that I read about in Southern cookbooks.
Right.
And until I did it myself, I never realized that it completely changes the cornbread, it completely changes the buttermilk, and you've got this new...
It's this new mush.
It's this
that
new
is
delicious.
So delicious.
I'm Melissa Clark. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Mario Batali. His new cookbook is called Big American Cookbook, and we have a few recipes on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Let's talk about some of those recipes. One of them is Amish beef and noodles, which to me sounds a little bit like chicken and dumplings, except with beef.
Yes.
And so tell us about that. It's a big stew?
Yeah, it's kind of stroganoff-y.
Stroganoff-y, okay.
But it's not got dairy in it. And the noodles are kind of puffy and plump, so they're different. It's a slow cooked thing, and it's perfect for the kind of weather that we're just about to approach.
Yeah, and we should all, you know, make it this weekend when it's going to be getting a little bit chilly. Here's a question, though. It calls for hand-cut Amish noodles.
Yes.
Is that something you make or you can buy?
You can buy them at the Amish store here in New York City.
The Amish store on 10th Avenue?
Exactly.
Okay, that's perfect.
Right. Or you can just make your own regular pasta noodles, just like you do from any of my Italian cookbooks, and just cut them like that. I roll them as opposed to thin like I would for fettuccine. I would roll them almost like between a 16th and an 1/8 of an inch thick, and I cut them kind of wide and irregularly.
Okay, along those same lines, there's a recipe in your book called Bot Boy, which is, that is like a German chicken and dumplings. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that recipe?
No, right off the top of my head.
Okay, so you have like a chicken, almost like a, like imagine chicken and dumplings. You have your chicken soup with the big pieces of chicken in it, and then you have these homemade noodles, and they're very slippery.
Right.
And that's possibly the bot boy. It possibly comes from pot pie.
Oh, right.
And then it's pasta, though, instead
of
pie crust.
And we put it under the broiler. I remember that.
Yeah.
And it gets kind of nice and firm on top. It almost feels like a pot pie because it gets crisp under the broiler. Delicious.
But you have with pasta dough instead
yes,
of that.
Yes, exactly. Instead of a flaky crust.
See, that's... why I like this book so much is because it's constantly surprises me.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about, you write about the South as being a place that is very close to its culinary history and its culinary roots. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that, all of America has amazing traditions and a lot of really cool things, but there's no place that is still a little less touched, a little less modernized, a little less more tied to its true traditions as the American South. And whether that's in New Orleans and Louisiana in the Cajun and Creole cooking, or whether it's kind of the low country cooking of the Carolinas, or whether it's the barbecue, or whether it's the Gulf Coast and where you're eating just, you know, the simple flavors of the local seafood catchery, just barely presented or barely treated. That's where I think you have the most, for me, the most authentic and most interesting flavors around the country. The ones that have been least chefified. You know, when I still go down there now and you get a po' boy and it has either shrimp or oysters or even just a fried grouper sandwich, for me is one of the greatest things I can ever have. And if I'm looking at the Gulf of Mexico and I didn't have one for breakfast, I have made a vast mistake.
So that's it. You like savory breakfast. You also write about clam fritters.
Yes.
One of your favorite breakfasts in the New England chapter. One of the interesting things about the way you organize this book is, well, it's by region, which is intuitive.
Right.
But then you split up the states sometimes.
Right.
So you have New York, both in New England
and in the Great Lakes. Right.
And Alabama, it's Gulf Coast, and also in South.
Right.
So,
because they kind of fit into two different ways. I mean, when you're in Buffalo, you're closer to, I mean, you're almost on Lake Erie, right? So it feels like you're in the Great Lakes, and the food is different than it is in New England. And, you know, the people in Buffalo, when you talk to them, they don't feel like they're upstate. They're actually offended by being upstate, and they certainly don't think of themselves as New Englanders. They're definitely Great Lakes, and they're closer in kind of strategy and cooking and people to the to the Midwest and the Great Lakes people. So that the food is different. I mean, when you have beef on a weck, I mean, there's probably five or six variations on a roast beef sandwich. Beef on a weck, the weck itself is this amazing bun with the seeds and the salt, and it's just something so delicious. I fed one to Jimmy Fallon last week. He said it might be the best thing he's ever had in his life. I'm like, Fallon, come
really?
On.
Really? Wow.
On TV?
I
think he's being
maybe,
a little bit optimistic.
Maybe he meant the best thing that he's ever had in his entire life that day.
That day.
Yeah.
I believe that might be true.
Okay, but why I want to just take that apart a little bit more, because I'm interested, why is Buffalo so much more like the Great Lakes, and what is that strategy of cooking? You said that there's this particular strategy of cooking there.
Right. Well, I don't think they have the roots. They don't have the New England style cooking roots. They don't have like a Boston feel to Buffalo. Buffalo feels a little bit more Midwestern. And Boston and New England feels very coastal to me. Mm-hmm. It feels very colonial. Buffalo doesn't. Buffalo feels elite to me, a lot more aligned with Toledo and Cleveland than it does, and Cincinnati, than it does, say, Boston and New Hampshire and Providence, Rhode Island. Providence, Rhode Island feels to me, the cooking is, for me, is almost Italian, and then a lot of seafood. The stuffies, for example, the stuffed giant clams that they eat there, feels a little bit more like New England-y to me, and that's kind of where that region.
What about the Portuguese?
There's a lot of that, and the sausage with the shellfish feels good there. And there's an Italian Portuguese. There's a Mediterranean backbone to that you don't necessarily find in the Midwest like that. For me, the Midwest is more kind of Northern European, Eastern European.
Let's go back to the South for a second, and also the Midwest. Let's talk about the American tradition of barbecue. This is a huge topic. There are so many styles of barbecue. Can you just talk a little bit about the different barbecue styles?
Well, in North Carolina, there's three distinct styles. There's the whole hog, there's the shoulder, and then there's the chopped, very finely chopped shoulder and whole hog, where they take the crispy bits of the skin and they chop it up all in it. Sometimes they pull it. But basically, it's really divided by how you sauce it. North Carolina is kind of two or three basic sauces. One of them is just a red vinegar and chili flakes and no tomato-y at all. And then another one has a little bit of ketchup in with that same thing, and it's still kind of spicy. Then in South Carolina, they have a mustard-based sauce that is kind of a reduction of vinegar, a little bit of hot sauce, a little bit of butter, and yellow, like Coleman's mustard, not Coleman's, French's mustard. And they kind of smoke the meat in a very similar way. They don't really treat it that much differently. It depends on whether you're using shoulders or whether you're using the whole pig. And then it's how they serve it. And it's perhaps the most beguiling and delightful thing going on in America right now. And you can get it a lot of places. You can definitely buy smoked meats. One of my favorite places to get barbecue in New York is at Hometown Barbecue in Red Hook.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And there's a guy named Billy Durney that makes it so spectacular. But I wouldn't say that it's North Carolina style. It's not South Carolina style. It's not Texas style. It's not Kansas City style. It's its own thing because he uses a lot of Asian flavors. But what he does have mastered completely, and I love the Asian flavors in his stuff, but what he does have mastered completely is that slow, harmonious balance of the smoke and the meat and the fire. And you're in there and you're tasting it. It's just like, I rarely eat bad barbecue when I'm in North and South Carolina.
And then don't forget, I'm sure the Texans will be calling
right.
up.
Oh, well, I love the Texas barbecue, but I got to say, like the brisket I was late to brisket. I didn't ever really figure it out for a long time because I was always thinking I wanted ribs.
Well, you know what? Brisket is glad to have you back. Mario Batali is going to be signing copies of his new cookbook this Sunday at noon at the Bookmark Shop in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. He'll also be signing books at Books and Greetings in Northvale, New Jersey on Sunday, October 30th. For more information, visit wnyc.org/lopate. Big American Cookbook, 250 Favorite Recipes from Across the USA, is published by Grand Central Life and Style. Mario, thank you.
Thanks for having me. We'll